I've been to Edgerton, Darlington, Middleton, Hubbleton, Hub City, Cuba City, Genoa City, Ashburn, Ashland, Packwaukee, Pewaukee, Waukesha.
Mix and match elements of hockey, soccer, basketball, and football. And what do you come up with? Ultimate Frisbee. Millions of people all over the world play Ultimate Frisbee. It was invented in 1968 in New Jersey. Students at UW-Madison founded an Ultimate Frisbee Club about a decade later. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for the Joy Cardine Show. We're learning about Ultimate Frisbee this hour with David Gesner. He got serious about Ultimate in the 1980s when the sport was still relatively obscure. His new memoir contains a healthy dose of Ultimate Frisbee history. It's titled Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession in My Wild Youth. He's chair of the Creative Writing Department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. When did you realize that Ultimate Frisbee was in your DNA?
Well, it was a strange thing. I was a freshman at Harvard in 1979, and I had planned on rowing crew because that's what my roommates were doing. And I was walking over the bridge over the Charles River, and I was with these crew guys, and I saw a Frisbee on the other side of the bridge, some guys throwing a Frisbee back and forth, and it looked like freedom to me. So I decided not to spend the next 4 years as a galley slave, and I followed the Frisbee, and I went to practice, and they were throwing it around in a football-like game. And I was a high school athlete, so I loved the way the disc hovered. So I was diving for it and jumping. And I was having a great time, but this guy, you know, if I'd expected to find snobbery at Harvard, I didn't expect to find it on the Frisbee fields. There was this snobby Frisbee player who played with an elite team, and he was spinning the disc on his finger and doing all these little tricks, and he criticized the way I was cutting and the way I was throwing because I was a beginner. So I stormed off. I said, enough of this, and I stormed off, and the captain ran after me and tried to talk me into coming back. And he said just the right words to make me stay. He said, you're going to be great at this. And that might have been the first. So I came back to practice. And then the next week I was at Bate College in Maine. And I went up in the air high and caught a disc over another guy. And came down and my team ran out, mobbed me. And I said, oh, I feel kind of loved here. So that was like the beginning of what would turn into a almost 20-year obsession for me.
Yeah, you really poured your heart and soul into the game, and you got really good at it.
I got good. I called myself the greatest player of all time by far, but that was not true. It was kind of a Muhammad Ali-like moment. One thing about Ultimate players is that there were no referees or coaches, so you could delude yourself as to your own greatness. But I got good, and I played with the number two, number three team in the country, never quite won it all, which is one of the things the book is about, you know, about these quests that you don't quite succeed at, but the passion and the obsession of the quest itself being just as important.
Well, we talk about
The sport is the same way because it's got, you know, when you tell somebody, particularly back when I played, I think in Madison, you could probably, you know, one out of two people would probably say, oh, yeah, Ultimate Frisbee. But when I played...
Ooh, you think one out of two people, huh?
I think it's one out of two people under 40, maybe.
Okay. Oh, now you're going to qualify it.
Yeah.
Carry on.
It better be at a college town, first of all.
Okay.
I remember I was. I will not cast aspersions, but I was in a rural place where I really hurt my shoulder, and I told the nurse how I had done it, you know, Ultimate Frisbee. And she burst out in laughter. So you get this, you know, particularly back when I played, you have this kind of inferiority complex as a sport because you tell people what you do and it's like you're telling them you're a professional tiddlywink player or something. And, you know, it's a running sport. The disc is moved through the air fluidly. It's kind of like, you know, those combos that you described. But when you catch it, you have to stop. You can't travel forward. And then you move it forward by throwing. As soon as it's knocked down, it goes in the other direction. So there's tons of running, you know, comparable to soccer, and there's jumping when you go up for the disc because it hovers for you. And so it's just very, particularly now, people just train all the time for it. But it's still, I think it's doomed a little bit by the word frisbee, which isn't even used anymore, and it's just called ultimate, But ultimate's not so great either. It's kind of a pretentious adjective. So so it's got name problems. It's got marketing problems. But, you know, more and more people know what it is. Maybe not one out of two.
Well, I laughed a bit in your book when you mentioned this bumper sticker that says every ball wants to be a frisbee, and I'm paraphrasing. I'm not sure what that meant, but it's
when a ball dreams, it dreams it's a frisbee.
That's it. So, what is it about a frisbee that is so amazing, and yet it doesn't get all of the love?
Well, you know, part of the reason it doesn't get the love is we're right at the you know, you said 68 was when we started, and we're at the point in basketball's life where it wasn't even in the Olympics yet, you know, and we're being considered. So the part of it is it's this, you know, people probably didn't jump up and down and think it was a great idea to have a ball, an oblong ball made out of a pig originally either, you know, for a football. So there's that. But the physics of the Frisbee are the fact that it waits for you. You know, when you look at SportsCenter Top 10, you'll see so many of those outfield dives, the baseball dives.
Yeah.
Well, you have the equivalent of that in Frisbee, but you have a hovering disc, which means it looks like people are catching things that are impossible to catch because it's kind of waiting for them. And then it sits up high. So, you know, if you had LeBron James or somebody going up for it, they'd be catching it at 11 feet. And then there are the throws, where I could, you know, throw something that went out of bounds on one side of the field and slice back to the other, or throw an overhead, which is like a football kind of a spear-like throw. So there's a lot of creativity in it, and that's part of what appealed to me is the creativity.
But it was still, you know, has its origins in being a child's toy. Can it ever break free of that bond of being a toy and being more of an instrument of this elite and thinking game of ultimate?
I think it can. You know, that, you know, maybe in 10,000 years or something. No, I mean it can in terms of like the thing about the sport was it was originally invented by Joel Silver, who is the, you know, the producer, much parodied producer, who gave us Lethal Weapon and Matrix and Xanadu. Well, he was in Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey, and as a lark, he raised his hand during a student council meeting and said, "I propose that we make a varsity frisbee team." So the sport's roots are kind of comic. You know, he started there, and it was kind of an ironic sport at first, but gradually people began to see the possibilities. But had Joel Silver, he's the one who called it Ultimate Frisbee, had he called it Field Disc, I think we'd have an easier job doing what you just described, you know what I mean? And I think so. I think people watching it helps. This is the first year where I got to sit down on the same in the same chair where I watched the Super Bowl and watched the college finals on ESPNU. That was fun to watch on real TV, beer in hand. And so I think it can happen, you know, stranger things. And it's being considered for the Olympics right now, too, so that's helpful.
It seems that you still really find community in it. You still say we when you refer to it. Do you still find do you still find that this is part of who you are? Your, you know, the inner you is this ultimate player.
Yeah, I mean, as you know from the book, it's partly also a memoir about becoming a writer, mm-hmm. and kind of a coming of age thing. And the two pursuits for me really reflected each other. They were both things that I was throwing myself into and that other people didn't get. You know, with writing, I hadn't published yet, so my father, and I'll talk about him a little more since Father's Day is coming, my father looked at it very skeptically. You know, when I graduated from Harvard and said I was going to be a security guard in a phone store in downtown Boston so that I could play Ultimate Frisbee, you can bet he looked at me like I was insane. But by doing these things that weren't given validation by the world, you kind of had to find your inner resources. And the epigraph of the book is a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, "Whoso shall be a man must be a nonconformist." So I built these muscles of nonconformity, but I didn't do it alone. You know, in writing, I was very isolated. I did do it alone. I didn't really have a community. But in Ultimate, I had this tribe. And the tribal aspect of it which I didn't really appreciate at first, was one of the biggest things about it. My team, the Hostages, in Boston, lived in these little Warrens. I know, exactly. We all wore the number 52 because there were 52 Iranian hostages.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it's just, my later team, when I was older, I played for a team called Father Throws Best. So
we have to run through these team names, and a shout out to the Madison Radicals and the Wisconsin Hodags. Yes, so we got to get those names out there. We're talking right now about the sport Ultimate Frisbee right now with David Gesner. His new memoir, Ultimate Glory, is an account of how the sport emerged from one with an obscure cult following to becoming much more accepted in the sporting ranks. Heck, you can watch it on ESPNU. Do you play Ultimate? If so, what can you share about it? Join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back after this news. All of its players are on the honor system, bound to call their own fouls, and there are no signing bonuses, no salaries for the sport. Ultimate Frisbee players pay their own way, but they retain the memories of the game and their team's best moments, reliving them over and over. Some of these great moments and players with these larger-than-life personalities are layered into the new memoir, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession and My Wild Youth, by David Gesner. David chairs the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Ultimate gets a bad rap in the sporting world? What is holding back Ultimate Frisbee? Should it be an Olympic sport? What does Wisconsin, how does Wisconsin rank in the ultimate world? Fill us in, 800-642-1234. David, I was struck in your book about these larger-than-life characters, very rich characters who had these incredible personalities, this engineer guy thinking only in algorithms and carrying that out there on the field. Do these characters, do you take them with you in your other writing and in the writing you do day to day?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't know if any Ultimate players are awake yet, so that might be a problem with getting calls in, because we used to call it Frisbee time. People would show up for an 11 o'clock game at 12:30. So, and one other thing, people do get paid now. There are pro league. You mentioned the Madison Radicals.
Yeah.
There is pro Ultimate in the last 5 years, and Bo Kittredge, who plays for Bay Area team, or played for Texas the year before, you know, didn't get paid a football salary, but he got paid pretty well. Also, his combine numbers were comparable with pro football players. He went to a pro football combine, ran a 4.4, ran a 47.400, which is, you know, only a couple seconds off the best. And so there are real athletes kind of moving into it, and there are, you know, it's not like attendance is booming at Pro Ultimate, but it's not like it's entirely empty either in the stadium. So it's starting to roll in that way too, which is pretty cool.
Well, isn't that typical? Isn't that typical that you need always in Ultimate to set the record straight and do a lot of defending?
Yeah, exactly. I'm feeling very defensive here. You know, you guys have on up. If you go to a game up there, I think they just signed Marquis Mason, who was a University of Wisconsin football player. He was injured a lot, but I think the Radicals signed him. So you're getting more and more, quote-unquote, real athletes playing. So that's kind of cool. But in my day, one of the reasons you had such characters is, as you said, there weren't referees. There really wasn't. You weren't going to see yourself on TV afterward. It wasn't filmed a lot. So the field was your stage. And one of the most famous characters, the one I played against a lot, was Kenny Dobbins. His dad was Lloyd Dobbins, who was this one of the pioneers of late-night TV, along with Linda Ellerbe. And Kenny was obsessed with Ultimate. He had this chant, which was Ultimate, Girlfriend, Work, God. I think those were his priority orders. Maybe God was a little higher. I know it's... but he... just worked all one fall. He didn't shower the whole fall to show his commitment to playing, and he'd train and train and then play. And then the most famous story with him is he dove. You know, there's a lot of, it looks like flying a lot when you see these guys flying through the air, and I kind of crumpled to the ground, but these guys fly through the air and caught the disc, and he ruptured his kidney.
Oh.
And he was told by the doctor, you know, you can't do this anymore. And the next week he was out there in a flak jacket playing again. So he was, he kind of embodied to me, he was like kind of a border collie chasing after a disc or something. He embodied to me this effort and trying, you know, that really translated to other pursuits too for me, like writing. This idea of, like, he seemed like kind of this living embodiment of will and ambition. So he was one of the characters. And then my teammate, Steve Mooney, was kind of his archenemy, which is a funny thing about Ultimate. You had kind of this fantasy world where you had archenemies, and you did put on your kind of superhero uniform on the weekend. You know, you some people could have, like, dull jobs, and then they'd go off to exotic lands in their superhero uniform for the weekend and throw the disc around. But Steve Mooney, my teammate, was 6'7", and this real brilliant athlete, and he could never quite beat the fiery little Kenny Dobbins character. So it was fun to write about these guys, and they don't really, you know, I never wrote about Ultimate. I wrote about environmental issues, and I wrote a lot about my dad, a memoir about my dad, and then gradually my agent said, let's try this Ultimate thing. And so I went home and I just wrote it in this. I took all the oral tradition of the sport and poured it onto the page. And I was so excited. And at the time, I remember, I was a starving writer, and my wife and I had about $50 in our joint bank account. And I heard through a mutual writer friend that my agent was really excited, that editors were really excited. And this was 1998, they almost took the book. But the marketers basically came to them and said, what I've been saying to you, is that the thing you do with dogs? You know what it was. So that was 20 years ago almost, and I've only recently resurrected the subject material because of the Olympics, it got a lot of press in the New York Times and New Yorker, and that led to that.
Do you feel like Ultimate is finally getting its time, its due time? Do you feel like everything's aligning for Ultimate?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we'll see. I think the game, I've got to go back to, because I have been so defensive so far during this hour, I want to say that the book isn't all defensiveness. It's also celebrating the, like, kind of joy and transcendence of the game itself.
Sure.
You're not out there running around with your teammates thinking, oh, no one respects our sport. You're running around thinking, oh, I'm going to catch this disc. So, you know, there's an excitement.
Well, let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Paul in Grafton. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Some of us are up,
Paul.
David.
Huh?
Some of us are up, David. We're still we've gone past Ultimate time.
Well, one of the reviews of the book said it's a coming of age story, but it's a really slow coming of age.
That's totally true. I'm actually just a little younger than you, and I have played against Kenny Dobbins and Steve Mooney.
Whoa.
All right. So the tradition continues.
I did a little research.
Are you a Madison player from
I played in Madison from 82 until 87, and then I played with Team Iguana in Los Angeles from 89 until 93, 94, something like that. And I came back and moved back to Milwaukee and played a couple more years, and my left knee finally gave out, and I've been retired about 8 years now.
Well, remember Alex Sokoloff? You probably overlapped with
him. I do. I played with Alex at Iguana. He was there for a couple years.
One year we were in the semis, Boston was in the semis, and you guys were in the semis, and I sang the whole night to him that song about barbecued iguana, or I want to live in.
I do remember that. I actually do. I remember that discussion.
I love this. I love this reunion, guys. Okay, hi. You're on a talk show right now. Just kidding. Well, Paul, tell us, what is your job today? How does Frisbee fold into your life today?
Well, I actually have two jobs. I actually am a personal trainer in the AM, and still have my passion for fitness. I've always been very, exercise has always been important, and I actually own a craft beer bar in Grafton. My other passion is craft beer.
That folds nicely into if ultimate, yeah.
I actually just went back, and we had a little reunion. We gathered 14 of the old farts, and we were honorary captains at the Radicals game against the Dallas team 2 weekends ago at Bree Stevens Field in Madison. Madison's still my hometown, and I miss it very much, so that was kind of neat. And I was invited to play on the Grand Masters team, which is 50 and over, but I don't think I'm going to be able to make it this year, but I was thinking maybe next year.
Well, you won't see me then in Denver, because I'm going to play with the great Grand Masters team here. Hey, we should point out, too, Paul, that because this is a Wisconsin show, that the Madison team, the Hodags, have won 3 college national championships since, like, 2001.
That's
correct. And so it's a proud tradition around here.
Yeah, a force to be reckoned with. Well, Paul, thank you so much for calling in and the reminiscing. We really appreciate it. Let's now go to Jeremy in Kakana. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I was just calling in because I was really excited to hear this topic. I remember being a junior and senior in high school, and when I was talking to college recruiters, my one question for them was, are there opportunities to play Ultimate on campus? Because there are some of the best memories I made during summer leadership camps. And I know that I never realized there was such a high level of organized play. I wish I would have gotten into it sooner, but maybe it's never too late.
Yeah, maybe you should check out a Madison Radicals game. It's pretty amazing what level it is now, and it's not too late. Like I said, I'm playing on a great Grandmasters team that's 50 and over, and so there's all levels at this point. So, it's a game that gets you hooked for sure.
Hey, David, why does Ultimate resonate on college campuses? Why, does it really have its hold there?
Well, I think, we've talked a little bit about the defensive aspect, but there's also the rebellious aspect of Ultimate. And, when you're that age, you want to kind of turn away from the traditional at times. And it's got its own traditions, but it's also inherently rebellious. There's a funny story where there's always been, you've asked about, is Ultimate going to make it kind of thing. There was a moment when I played when Jose Cuervo, which had just taken beach volleyball from nothing and made it a television sport, they came to try to do that with Ultimate. And they ran these tournaments. And Ultimate players they refused. They would wear those shirts with the same numbers or not wear numbers.
Yeah.
They would smoke joints on the sideline. And then at the final party, after the final game, Cuervo thought it was a good idea to have an hour of free tequila with Ultimate players. So at the end of the hour, the Ultimate players crawled over the bar and grabbed more, and the Cuervo executive said, these guys aren't ready for prime time. And the guy who was running the tournament, who was also an Ultimate player, said, if we can't sell this sport to a tequila company, who can we sell it to? So it's always been a movement forward, getting more professional, and then a fun regression. And so that's the answer to your question, I think, is like, it's fun. It's an inherently fun thing, but it's also a different thing. And we're looking for different things at that age.
And it's also a very community-building thing. Tell us about this thing happening after the game. There's this milling that happens.
Yeah.
Well, what's up with that?
The mill or milling period. Most of the fans watching a high-level Ultimate game, and, it's like a tournament, so it goes all weekend. You play, 8 or 9 games. But the final game, most of the fans watching are Ultimate players themselves. And in my day, we rung the field. We were right on the field, and heckling was a big thing. You'd mock players who you didn't like, or even ones you liked. You'd tease them. And this was more of an East Coast thing, maybe. But then when the game ended, right on the field and right around the field, people would be drinking beer and just talking about their great plays they had or the great plays somebody else had. And that could go on into dark for a couple hours, and great sense of community. And then, of course, I have in the book the fact that, I kind of refused to grow up throughout my 20s. And then, strangely, a week before I turned 30, I was operated on for testicular cancer, and during that week, I waited to find out kind of what type of cancer I would have. And it turned out it was a seminoma, which was the best case for me. And halfway through the week, my girlfriend, who was also an Ultimate player, said, "What do you want to do for your birthday now that you know you have, you know, the good stuff, the better type of cancer?" And I said, "A party." And she said, "Small or big?" And I said, "Big." And we had this huge Ultimate party a week after, on my 30th birthday. And, you know, it was a real primal thing because I was celebrating the fact that I would live, you know, and that was exciting. But I looked around the room, and there were maybe 60 people there, and 55 of them were Ultimate players. So it was really very much my support group, my community, and my tribe.
Ultimate got through you through that cancer scare.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd love to talk for a minute about my dad, since Father's Day is coming. I don't know if we're closing in on a break or not. Maybe I should wait till the other.
Wow, you're so aware of how these shows work. I'm really pleased. Well, how about this? Why don't we take one more call here? Gene in Madison. Okay. Hi, Gene.
Yeah. Oh, good morning, and congratulations on your health and all that. That was a good story. Well, I just wanted to put in another plug for the Radicals because it's just really a pleasant experience to go to one of the games. They are held at Bree Stevens Field, which was recently refurbished in the last few years, and it's just kind of it just feels like a really magical place to be, whether you're seeing a concert or the Mad Gale Irish Festival at the end of August is there with Irish music. But the Radicals games is just a fun place to be. They have a lot of food and beer, and there's lots of families there, and it's a really relaxed atmosphere and fun to watch. The time just kind of goes. It feels really relaxing. So it's a nice experience. People should check it out. Bree Stevens is like near east side of Madison, East Washington, a few blocks from the Capitol. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And Gene, thank you so much for calling in and describing that atmosphere. It seems like a world away, David, from where Ultimate started on, you know, a scrappy field, originally even just in a parking lot.
Yeah, yeah. It started in Columbia High School parking lot. And, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, the roots were hippie roots. But really, Joel Silver and his gang from Columbia High School, they were more kind of cynical geeks than hippies. And they played, it was really a social event. They played in this parking lot at night, and the football team would come by and throw eggs at them. So they were, and only gradually did the athleticism start to kind of come out. And then, you know, another thing that's different about current Ultimate, I went back to Nationals to watch the finals, the championship, it was played in a stadium, and people were further back from the field. It wasn't like that milling period type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, this is too clean. Everything is, where's the grubby? It used to look like extras from Braveheart out there, you know, in the mud and blood and I was like, oh, the game's gotten too clean. But I'd love to. I've never seen a pro game, which is I should do, obviously, having written the book. And she mentioned fields. I did a little Madison. Somebody can call and correct me if they're wrong, but the team is called the Hodags.
Yes, yes.
And they, a big moment for them apparently was when they got this indoor training field that they didn't get it. The school got it, and they get to use it once a week. And I think it's called, what is it called? The McLean Field, I guess.
Yeah, we're going to need to fill in some blanks here on that. Shout out to the Hodags here. They're a force to be reckoned with in the men's collegiate ranks in Ultimate. 800-642-1234. Add your voice to the conversation about Ultimate Frisbee and how it's played a role in your life. For thousands of athletes around the world, Ultimate Frisbee is a demanding, full-time sport that sometimes just doesn't get its moment in the sun. We'll be back after this news. We're back talking about Ultimate Frisbee this hour with author David Gesner. His new memoir is a healthy part homage to the sport that never really gets the full ESPN limelight, although he may disagree. Gesner chairs the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. In his 20s, he put his heart and soul into the game for a decade, getting serious about it in his years at Harvard. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for the Joy Cardine Show. Have you played Ultimate Frisbee? What is it that makes it so different from other sports? Do you remember your first experience with a Frisbee? Add your voice, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We also had a caller who couldn't stay with us who said she's played Ultimate a few times and really enjoys it. She said she thinks it's like any other sport and should be considered as an Olympic sport. David, what are its chances? What is the status of that?
You know, I honestly, you know, there was a big hubbub when they started considering it. And I think this summer they're playing the World Games in Poland. Ultimate is being played. And I think that's kind of a trial for the Olympics. But I honestly haven't heard the next step. And as far as the callers talking about it being a real sport, I live in North Carolina, as you said, and that's where I teach. But I come out to Boulder, Colorado every summer to house it for 3 weeks. And tomorrow I have a Wisconsin native visiting me, James Campbell. I call him Jim Campbell. He's the author of Braving It, and he's the producer of The Last Alaskans, and he's an old friend we met in grad school in Colorado. And I bring him up because he was a huge rugby player. Mm. And there's a really good parallel, you know, with a club sport, you know, that has a passionate following and has its world of its own, and also has an overlap in terms of beer with Ultimate Frisbee. Because I thought it was funny that the caller, that's what he does. He does fitness in the morning and beer in the afternoon.
You know, it pairs very well with his background. Yeah.
Also, the timing does, because you work out in the morning and then have beer afterwards. I got reviews, a couple really nice reviews, unexpected reviews in the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal in the last week, and both of them use the phrase "lots of beer." So that's another part of the tribe also.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't want the hour to slip by without me doing a little Father's Day thing, and that I had this kind of gruff, kind of look like Lou Grant kind of dad. He was bald probably by the time he was in his late 20s, and he was a businessman. And he said, "You're playing what?" when I first, you know, told him what I was doing. But as a kid, he was super competitive, and he gave out these little trophies that said Kid of the Year. There were four of us.
No way, really?
And I never won because I was the oldest, and he figured I could take it. And as I was researching this, I actually found my trophy, and it said Kid of the Year, participant. I was not, you know. And he also was just like, if I get a 98 on a test, it was like, what happened to the other 2 points? So finally, he came out to watch an Ultimate game. The one time he watched, and this was during my senior year at Harvard, and we had this guy who was a physics genius on the team, but he looked like a caveman. He was a Neanderthal, kind of long red hair and beard and mustache, and he loved to throw it as far as he could deep with his backhand, which was really strong. And we used to say he had a notion, which meant he thought, you know, he saw somebody and he'd throw it. We caught it on the sidelines, and my dad was kind of drinking a beer and chortling at the silly game he was watching, but he should have been paying closer attention, because this teammate of mine, Nathan, wound up and threw it, and it would have gone about 100 yards, but it only went 2 and knocked my dad to the ground. And the fans and the players all gathered around, and he kind of gamely got to his feet. But I say in the book, if I had more Robert Bly in me, I would have realized that this is what my inner wild man was going to do to my inner businessman over the next decade. I was going to knock it to the ground. It was symbolically just like Ultimate itself for me. My dad, I'm 56 now, and he died when he was 56, so I've been thinking about him a lot this week, and he ultimately started to come around to appreciate. If he didn't really appreciate the game, he appreciated the passion, you know, that I threw into the game. So,
because he was such a passionate person himself.
Yeah, and competitive. He liked the winning part of it.
yeah, I bet he did. And you had other family members who also watched you play. I think in the book you talked about sharing a bed with one.
Yeah. Well, my grandfather, Earl Christensen, didn't really have much to do with the family. He kind of deserted my mom and family when he was young. But he played for the Yankees. Bizarrely, he played behind Lou Gehrig, who's famous for never coming out of, you know, never not playing a game. So he didn't play much. But he also was a golfer who won all these tournaments. There was one in Ohio where he was the, not the low scorer, but he was the low scoring professional. So he won the money. And Jack Nicklaus at 17 was the low scorer. And he chortled, "Well, Jack, you have the, you know, you won, but I have the money," you know, which was just like my grandfather. So he came out and watched me play because he saw me being interviewed on TV when I was at the national championships in Florida. And being a cheap ultimate player, I went back to, he offered me a bed at his house. Little did I know it was his bed that I was going to share with him. And this was the night before the national championship. And before we went in, he lifted up the mattress and showed me the rifle he kept underneath. And so I didn't sleep at all the night before I played in the national championship. I was with my bizarre grandfather. So another double Father's Day.
Well, David, we're going to leave it there. It has been such a pleasure talking with you this hour. Really appreciate it.
And tell people to go out and try it. It's a blast.
I know you would get that one last pitch in. Very good. David Gesner, he's a professor at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. He's the author of the new book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession in My Wild Youth. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin went crazy for bicycling in the late 19th century, hailed as the most independent, healthful, rapid, and convenient mode of travel in the 1890s. Wisconsinites not only rode bikes, they made them. Tom Rademacher tells us about the Kenosha-made Sterling safety bicycle.
Bicycling in Wisconsin in the 1890s was called the most independent, healthful, rapid, and convenient mode of travel. As part of our ongoing look at objects from Wisconsin's past, Tom Rademacher tells us about the Kenosha-made Sterling safety bicycle.
Cycling in the 1890s was predominantly a male activity. However, this bicycle allowed women to also engage in the recreational sport of cycling. The Sterling safety bicycle, it was manufactured in 1899 by the American Bicycle Company. It has a lowered top tube, which accommodated the fashionable dresses of the time for women so that women could also go on rides. Bicycles entered into the United States in 1869 on the East Coast from Europe and then pretty much just steadily moved westward. And by 1880, there was a national association for bicycling called the League of American Wheelmen, which was founded on the East Coast. But Wisconsin had a Wisconsin State Division, and then there were about 40 local club divisions within Wisconsin. Wisconsin, at its peak, was ranked 8th in membership and one of the leading divisions of the West. The wheelmen, the bicyclists of the 1890s called themselves wheelmen. So the wheelmen of the 1890s created promotional materials like handbooks, maps, and things like that, which enabled cyclists of that era to link up with other clubs in the area, find the best roads for cycling, and avoid the worst ones, because most roads in the 1890s were just mud and dirt trails unless you were in a large city like Milwaukee. And so it was oftentimes difficult to actually enjoy the sport on the poor roads. And they would publish pamphlets and materials trying to promote the need for better roads. But they also tried to get people like farmers on board and advocated for farmers, trying to get them to understand that a better road will help get their produce to market.
Where there's a wheel, there's a way. But with bicycles, the way has been rather tortuous. There were no traffic signals in those rollicking days.
Interestingly, the company actually switched from manufacturing bicycles to then automobiles at the turn of the century once the bicycle boom ended. And this is just a reflection of how quickly the decline of bicycling happened and show us the start of the rise of automobiles as being a premier mode of transportation. I'm a big fan of cycling, and I wanted to learn more about the history of biking in Wisconsin. The part that interests me the most about the safety bike and the movement is the interesting connections that can be seen in the 1890s as well as to today, because a lot of the materials that the Wheelman published in the 1890s are things like maps and route materials and listings of bike shops and hotels for people to travel to. And that's the same kind of material that organizations will put out today for their members. It's over a century ago, but yet we can still do the same kinds of things today.
That story was produced in partnership with Wisconsin 101, a collaborative effort to share Wisconsin's story and objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Thank you, Erica. The Joy Cardine Show is produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent in for The Joy Cardine Show, and you find the ultimate conversation every day here on the Ideas Network. Coming up Monday at this time, NBC is taking heat over its decision to air an interview that host Megyn Kelly conducted with right-wing radio host and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Critics say the network is giving Jones a bigger platform to spread misinformation, but Kelly has defended the interview. Our guest, media ethicist, weighs in on how the press should cover controversial figures. That's Monday here on The Joy Cardine Show. Hope you can join us for that.